everyone, welcome to the third episode of Murder, She Spoke, the Murder, She Wrote podcast that is going through and discussing every single episode. Today is Season 1, Episode 3, Deadly Lady. When you first start playing the episode, which I've been playing it on Amazon Prime Video, you'll notice that the intro is still 44 seconds long. And also in the credits, you'll notice this is the first appearance of Tom Bosley. He is a recurring character within the series. This is also the first episode set in where the town she lives, Cabot Cove, the town Jessica Fletcher lives. And honestly, my favorite episodes all take place in Cabot Cove. I mean, there are some really good ones that take place other places, but nothing's better than a good old Cabot Cove mystery. Right during the credits, we have a camera shot catching the rain, the storm, and then there's a clap of thunder around 1:39, and honestly, it is the fakest sounding thunder I've ever heard. But still, great cinematography, great filming. I like the kind of distorted shot through the window at 1:40 where the camera's looking like through one window, or it looks like it's looking for, like, there are two windows, and then you can see Jessica in the last window writing. Very distorted and kind of spooky. I like it. I went back and replayed that section from, like, when they pan from the ocean to Jessica in the window, because I wanted to see if there were two windows there. It looks like her laundry room is kind of like on an enclosed porch. Like, you see a washer and dryer and glass surrounding that, but then, like, you can see there's a window behind the washer and dryer, so it looks like she had a porch there that she enclosed, and now it's like her laundry sort of room. But also, if you listen, when you hear that first strike of thunder, you can tell it's being played on a loop, because the from when the first one plays, it's on a very, like, it's the same amount of time between each one. And the only reason I know that is because I have some major OCD, and repetitive noises really bother me, and I can determine whether something, like, you'll hear it, I heard the thunder, and then the thunder played again, and I knew exactly when it was going to hit again. It's just, it was timed exactly the same. So, that was kind of annoying. Thank goodness after the third clack of thunder, they kind of stopped it, because Jessica had some lines. Jessica is typing on her typewriter, and after that third clack of thunder, the lights start to flicker, and it's really adorable how she's like, she kind of prays to the ceiling, or saying, you know, what she does is really cute. You'll have to see it. It's around 1:54. She's talking about how she only has three more pages and then she can go to bed. I'm sorry, I looked at it again. Three more paragraphs, not pages. Then the lights go off again and she says, thank you. But I can't, she only types a few sentences from what I can tell. But she says thank you to the lights going off right like a second after that. And I can't tell if they went out when she wanted them to go out after she finished her three paragraphs. But she kind of looks irritated, so I'm thinking she might have been saying that sarcastically. So the lights go out, she gets up and stops writing. Well, if I would have kept watching instead of questioning everything I saw, would have answered the laundry room thing, because as Jessica gets up from the typewriter, she lights an freaking oil lamp, which, okay, oil lamps are great. But also, like, who uses an oil lamp anymore? And this isn't like the early 1900s. This is set in the 80s because it was filmed in the 80s. I'm making the assumption that it's set in the, yeah, it's definitely set in the 80s. So as she's lighting her oil lamp, someone's banging on the door, and it's her friend, the police officer, Captain Ethan Craig, played by Claude Akins. This is a recurring character, but he's only in a few episodes and ends up leaving after that. I don't know why, but I'm kind of glad because I don't really like him. Like, he's replaced later on, and honestly, the characters they end up introducing are a lot better than this one. So he is a police officer, and he is coming in because there's a hurricane, and he's checking on Jessica to see if she's okay, and she, like, says something super sarcastic, and he, like, laughs, or is like, at least your tongue's all right. And here we have a special instance of him saying the name of the episode. He refers to the storm as, hey, we have a real deadly lady here. And that's the title of the episode. It is not referring to a murdered body, as you may think. Honestly, it's really sweet that he came over to Jess's house to make sure that she was okay. He didn't go over to tell her anything in particular. He just went to check on her. She reassured him she was fine. She said she had light, candles, firewood, and he was going straight to bed anyway. And he said he was going straight to bed also and I'm glad she was okay. And then he casually mentions that the Coast Guard is radioing in that there is a ship or a yacht out there in the storm, which is foreshadowing, obviously. But it's really played out very casually. It's not like, oh, I suddenly heard this over the radio. There's a yacht. I better go see, you know, like, I better go take care of it. It was just like he wasn't in charge of taking care of it. He just mentioned it in passing, like, as, like, two friends would, like, can you believe there's a yacht out there? Some people are idiots. And it was just really casual, no focus on what he said, which was, I like the way that they write this. The next scene, it cuts to Jessica doing her morning jog, which is so fake, you can super tell. And she jogs to the wharf or whatever, and there are three fishermen there. She's clearly close with everyone. They're all around her age or a little bit younger. Everyone loves Jessica, so, I mean, who wouldn't? She's lovely. So she goes and chats, small town, you know, chatting. The fisher that talks to her has a transatlantic accent, and I love transatlantic accents. You can tell a lot of the characters, even the ones with bit parts, are very well-trained actors. Jessica runs awkwardly home and sees a random, strange, scruffy-looking man clipping her hedges. awkward. And I like how she just, like, it's almost like she's trying, it seems like she's acting like she's butting her nose in someone else's business, but, like, it's her house. And she's just like, what the hell? 2 seconds later, he reveals that he needs food, and he would rather do hard work in exchange than having a handout. I mean, definitely, like, that generation sort of just starting to work on someone's stuff without asking and then saying, you know, hey, I'll do this for you, even though I'm already doing it without your permission. I mean, I don't like people touching my stuff. And Jessica clearly felt the same way initially. She was like, oh, this is private property. But then he revealed what he was doing and he was, you know, helping her out. And she understood and she was like, oh, okay, come on in. And then she's like, I don't know. Okay, I need to stop, like, literally quoting the whole show. But yeah, so Jessica goes from, what are you doing, to, oh yeah, I agree with you. I, like, you know, it's admirable for people to work for whatever. And she invites him in her house, like, straight up, like, this scruffy, gross-looking guy that she doesn't know, that clearly is alluded to, that he's clearly, like, homeless or something, doesn't have any money, and she just brings him right into her house. That is clearly her Cabot Cove mindset, that she's not in any danger, which we learned in an earlier episode, that she just walks down any alley, dark alley in New York City, and takes her chances, and she got straight up beaten to the ground by muggers, yet she's totally cool. Like, that happened in the last episode, and she's still cool bringing random people into her house. But I guess if the captain or people check on her all the time, that's pretty reasonable, like, to feel like you're safe if people are around you all the time. So Jessica makes him food and calls him out on his bullshit. She Sherlock Holmes' ass. He is claiming that he's poor, homeless, whatever. He realizes who she is, J.B. Fletcher, because he sees one of her books. And then she calls him out on his shit because she says that, she points out that he has a suntan where he had a watch, and that his clothes are worn, but they were exquisitely tailored. And I love when people do that, like in TV shows where they, I call it Sherlock Holmesing it, where they call out a bunch of things that normal people wouldn't notice. I really enjoy that. He claims that I don't know if he's telling the truth. I can't remember this episode. He told her that, I mean, why would I trust him to begin with? Because he lied the first time around, like 2 seconds before this. He said that he, just retired. And that he got a good pension, gold watch, and whatnot. And he decided to spend his time exploring the country. Rather than taking a tour bus, he decided to, essentially, it's not, he didn't say he was hitchhiking, but that's the kind of, like, way he's going about things. Like, he travels any way he can. He earns food and shelter by working. But the fact that he said he could have taken a tour bus around the old-fashioned way with all the other old people means that I'm pretty sure he does have money, based on that, and that he said he got a pension and he hasn't been doing the couch hopping thing for very long. Honestly, it just sounds like he kind of wants some new experiences. So, as they're talking, she gets a phone call and tells him that he can work. There are a lot of things to do. He can work there. And here is our first appearance of Tom Bosley as Sheriff Amos Tupper. Honestly, his character lasts for a while in the show, a few seasons. he's just so good. He's so good. So he calls Jessica, and they're clearly close. He calls her, and he's like, the yacht from the night before, apparently, like, they were able to get it back to shore, to the dock, but, he said there's something murderous afoot, essentially, and she says murder while she's on the phone, and the guy in her house looks over, and the way they frame the shot, he's sitting at the table, and she's behind, like, he's in the foreground, she's in the background, and it's his profile against her profile, but they're facing different directions. And she's talking, she's like, murder, and he turns to look at her because he's listening, but that means his back of his head is towards the camera, and it's a very interesting shot. And the camera shot alludes to, along with the music, that the guy in her kitchen may have something to do with the murder. Right after that, Jessica leaves, gets on her bike like a boss, and the guy creepily watches her out the window as she leaves. And you can tell he is kind of concerned. But not concerned in a way that he would be the murderer. It seems more concerned that it's like, I don't know, something else. It's almost like he's concerned for her, because he's probably confused why some random old lady is getting a call from the sheriff about a murder, and she goes off to go look at it like it's her job. So next scene is her at the docks with the sheriff and captain. And the captain is 100% sexist. Apparently, there are three ladies in the boat, and he's claiming that those pretty little things couldn't kill nobody. And the sheriff, who's Tom Bosley, is like, this is my investigation. I know what I'm doing. Okay, so things aren't streamlined here in Cabot Cove. They keep trying to tell what happened, but the sheriff is interrupted by the captain, is he a captain? Yeah. And it's just a freaking mess. So he decides that four women that were on the boat, and along with their father, apparently is nowhere to be found. The father is the owner of a high-end cosmetics company, and they're all kind of like in that sort of business. Like one of the daughters, she designed a sweater, you find out in the beginning. Okay, so they go into some like hutchy fisherman's garage, and the daughters, one looks like a young Kris Jenner. What's the other one? The other one looks like someone. That's it. The other one looks like a young Sandra Bullock with blonde hair. It's interesting. Alright, so we're getting into some good shit right now. Jessica returns to the house. They talk. Her and Ralph, the vagrant. I'm trying so hard not to recap the whole damn story. Because, like, if you're listening to this, you clearly have seen the episode. Maybe not, but I'm trying to recap less and less, but it's really hard. So around 1357 in the episode, Ralph and she had already left all the daughters of the missing man. She's in her house with Ralph, the vagrant man. They're discussing things. He asks her about the murder. He made a random call to Paris, but he claims it was Paris, Kentucky. But she's pretty sure it was Paris, France, and that he's lying. So he picks up a pipe when they're in the living room, and it is Jessica's, her late husband's pipe. And the scoring, the camera shots, the acting, it is all so poignant. He's holding this pipe, and Jessica's not looking. And he's holding the pipe up at his eye level, standing there like a king would. And Jessica looks over, and the scoring is like really soft, tinkling on a piano. And the look she gives, she's not looking at the man, but at the pipe. And her eyes are kind of watery, and it's just her whole tough, fast, like, she's always moving around fast, talking herself out of things, or out of situations, being pretty upbeat. In that moment, everything drops, and, like, her face clears, and it's just, you see, like, this innocence. She is clearly upset, in an innocent sort of remembering her husband sort of way. Her eyes are watering, and she tells Ralph to take the pipe. And he's like, oh no, he clearly is reading her facial expressions. For some reason, she's forcing him to take this pipe. And it's a very lovely pipe. It looks like it's ivory, and there are a lot of carvings and detail in it. But she clearly, her face is saying, how dare you, don't touch my pipe, or my husband's pipe. But she told him to take it, and it looks like it's causing her physical pain. It's really a battle of her common sense logic self versus her heart. Mind versus heart. The classic struggle. Because she's a very practical person, and you can tell in the scene, she's like, you know, might as well be used rather than gathering dust. Because, like, honestly, her keeping the pipe and not letting anyone use it won't bring her husband back, and she's aware of that, but also, like, it's such a sentimental thing for her that those two elements are fighting against each other here. Next scene, there's a helicopter landing in a wheat field. It's the bougie-looking daughter's husband. Richie McRichpants douchebag is demanding a coroner's inquest. Because the reins of the company has to be turned over to someone quickly, or the company may crumble, and they can't do that unless there's a coroner's inquest. And the sheriff, he acts like, you know, a typical he seems like he's an unintelligent, uncivilized sort of pushover, but he's not. He's very black and white. He's saying that he's not going to do a coroner's inquest until he finds a body, because he believes, he's the only one at this point that believes that the father falling overboard was not an accident, even though that's how they described it. All the sisters described what happened, and it was very, like, honestly, I agree with him. It was very spot on. It was they knew the latitude, longitude, they knew the time. It was too perfect, honestly. Especially because they were on a boat. And they don't have cell phones. Like, I could see, like, nowadays, realizing, like, oh, we're looking at your phone, oh, it's this time. Oh, our dad hasn't come down from the deck. We better go see what if he's okay because of this crazy storm. But, like, they could have easily looked at their watch and realized, oh, he hasn't come down yet. So that would explain maybe why they knew what time it was when he was whisked overboard. But they're acting weird, and they're really pushing the coroner's inquest. So it looks suspicious, but not super suspicious. Like, the viewer isn't like, okay, yeah, it's clearly foul play. Like, it's pretty neutral at this point. I'd like to also comment on how the Richie McDouchebag, he is like, well, what? They might never find the body because obviously it's like lost in the ocean. The captain earlier was very convinced that the body would wash up on the shore that night or the night after, based on what they've seen before, I'm assuming. So I don't know if his logic is foolproof. Is it that certain? But the douchebag, he's like, they could never find the body. Like, we may never find the body. And the sheriff is like, yep. He, like, doesn't care. So the next shot at 1543 is a full shot of Jessica's house. And honestly, it's very unique. It is very lovely. It's very, like, I don't know how to describe it. First of all, it is a nice, like, Victorian-looking house, sort of. But it's, like, it's like having a closet full of white, ruffly dresses. Like, that's what it looks like in the house version. The house is completely white. Everything is white. But it's not like a bright white. It's like a sort of like a worn white, but it's still white. It's not off-white. It's 100% white. It's more muted white, like maybe matte white. There are white sort of chiffon drapes. You can see white door, white drapes on the door, lace, white gate, everything's white. The only thing that isn't white is the roof, and that is a soft gray. Gutters, white. Frames, like, literally nothing else is a color. Like, everything is absolutely white. And it's a very picturesque shot. When they show the shot of the house, it's like something you would see in, like, I don't know, like Psycho or a very, like, Alfred Hitchcock-esque. And it may be taken straight from Alfred Hitchcock, but I wouldn't know enough about that to pinpoint exactly. But it's a very simplistic, lovely house. On the inside, whole different story. But the outside is very, very reminiscent of Hitchcock sort of filming and stuff. Okay, so I love how Jessica sees a normal thing and it sparks her to think of something that may help the case, because that's how it works in real life. You're looking, in this case, also very Hitchcockian. I'm so proud of myself for mentioning Hitchcock in her house when the next scene is swirling water down a drain in a poetic way. I'm so good. So this whole, you know, the scene in the bathtub with in Psycho where the water's swirling down, 100% that scene, but in her dish sink while she's washing dishes. Though, ironically, or oddly enough, there's nothing in her sink but the soapy water. Then she runs off, and I just realized that her friend, the captain, what's his name? Captain something. He is not in the police. I thought he was a police officer ranked under the sheriff. Though I didn't understand why he was called captain. But who knows? He is a boat captain. And I believe he's in charge. I think he's in charge of, like, the marina. So Jessica runs off and finds him on a boat. Okay, so... Jessica... Well, one of the daughters, she admits to shooting her father. Because Jessica calls them out for being liars because they couldn't have been in the storm. It couldn't have been swept overboard. Okay, so I hate when, like, one character knows something but the police officer doesn't know yet, and they have to, like, there's all this, like, anticipation, like, get it out, tell them so everyone knows what's going on. So Ralph is the father, obviously, and they cooked up a scheme to make it look like he drowned to draw out this fortune hunter who was pretending he was in love with his daughter, which is such an insane scheme just to get rid of a guy that has a crush on his daughter. Like, but also, like, he, like, clearly must really care about his daughter because he paid this man $500,000 to never talk to her again. And then as soon as they, and he knew that as soon as he was presumed dead, he would come back into her life and try to steal more money or whatever, I guess. And he did. Like, as soon as it was announced he was dead, this guy came back. But the thing all, it went wrong. It went completely wrong because now he's actually dead, and no one knows who did it, because he was staying at Jessica's house, and he clearly didn't die overboard, and it's this whole mess now, but Jessica knows what's going on. This episode is very interesting, because it goes from father falls overboard, father possibly pushed overboard, father shot overboard. Meanwhile, it turns out to be a whole scam. Then it's found out that the father was actually shot in the way that they pretended that he was shot. And then it was a whole setup, and it's all back and forth, and it's really great. The whole episode is revolving around a pair of high heels. And the way, the evidence that is presented, like I mentioned in the previous episode, all the evidence is presented as Jessica sees it. She sees the evidence, it's in the scene, but not necessarily, the camera doesn't focus on it. She doesn't necessarily bring it up until she realizes what it is later. So that the viewer is seeing exactly what Jessica sees, and if the viewer doesn't put it together, then Jessica will eventually put it together and the viewer will understand. But in the scene where Jessica is talking about the high heels, and no one knows what heels they are. And when the one daughter is like, oh, I would never wear pink, like a bell went off in my head and I'm like, they specifically didn't tell anyone about what shoes they were or whatever, so clearly she's the guilty one because of the comment. And also, when Nan was putting on the shoes, when Jessica asked her to put the shoes on, Jessica was clearly checking the bottom of her feet to see if they're all scratched from walking on the rocks and everything. Those are things that were shown, but not explained what they were doing. Like, when she asked her to put the shoes on, they were her shoes, clearly her shoes. They obviously fit. But the whole point was actually to see the sole of her foot. But she didn't explain that until later. So the viewer had the chance to come up with that on their own before Jessica revealed that in a couple scenes later, which I find really interesting. Because it's like we're there seeing all the things that are coming to light, and we don't know anything that Jessica doesn't know. Like, we are on the same page as Jessica. We always know what she knows. And then Jessica, of course, waits for the murderer, and the murderer breaks into her house, and Jessica's there, and she's like, I knew you did it. And honestly, it's so clever, because Jessica's like, it wasn't a very good, you didn't do a good job. And the girl was like, it was clever. And Jessica's like, no, it wasn't, though. So Jessica may be a genius. She may put all the pieces together. But unlike a lot of men who are like her that solve crimes, they become very cocky. If a man was playing this role, he would have been put in way more danger, would have been killed several times over. Jessica is a practical person. She's aware she's an old lady. She's aware that she shouldn't take the law into her own hands when it comes to revenge or justice. She doesn't really overstep her boundaries when it comes to actual police work. She looks for clues, but those are things like anyone could do. She's not breaking or entering. If she's searching someone, she asks their permission. She doesn't think that she herself is above the law. And I think that's a very, very great dynamic. Because she gets a lot of crap because she's always curious about murders, but also, she's usually not the one who is butting her nose in first. Like, at the beginning of this episode, the sheriff calls Jessica. The sheriff calls her right away to get down there to hear out what happened to the man that fell overboard. But then when Jessica shows up on the beach to look for the murder weapon, and the sheriff's like, oh, what is she doing here? But, like, he invited her into the case. And honestly, everything she does is not to undermine him. It's to bring the truth to light. She wants to make sure the right person is accused. She doesn't want someone innocent going to jail. She's always out for the truth. And her ego, I mean, it's not all about her being right. It's all about who is really innocent, who is guilty. She accepts any help she can get, but she's always determined. If she has a hunch, she always believes in it. But a lot of times she's reluctant to say anything. Very much, and throughout the series, she is not a cocky person. she has fall often she falls into the position of detective, but it's not reluctant. She's not reluctant to take the position of detective. She's reluctant to take it. She's not reluctant to actually solve crime. She loves doing that, but she is reluctant to officially accept that she is solving these crimes. Like, when someone asks her to help her with something, she's all gone, like, she's down for it, but she also never wants to step on the sheriff's toes because they're really close. Unless he is going on the wrong tangent and she's like, oh my gosh, shut up, you're wrong. But it's funny how they work together, because in the one scene where they suggested to arrest Nan just to make, like, to bring out the real killer, and she's like, you can't arrest her, she's not the killer, and he's like, what? And then she's like, maybe you should arrest her, and he's like, now you're talking. Like, he didn't even care if she was innocent or not. Like, he's like, yeah, let's do it. And I enjoy that, and that they're friends together too. And then at the end, when Nan is leaving in the taxi, she said she'll promise to write Jessica, which makes me wonder how many letters does Jessica get? She knows thousands of people, and she's saved so many people. And she knows tons of people just from being a writer or being a relative or something. And I know young people tend not to get to writing, but, like, someone who's affected your life so drastically and saved you and helped you out, like, they would definitely write at least a few times. Like, honestly, Jessica must get so many letters or Christmas cards, which makes me think of that episode of Keeping Up Appearances where Hyacinth Bouquet, hangs all of her Christmas cards out, and she has, like, more than 200 Christmas cards hanging on her walls. And you find out, like, I mean, you usually get a Christmas card from someone if you send them one, but also, like, a lot of them were from Hyacinth. She put up a lot of her own cards, that she sent to herself, claiming that she sent them in lieu of people who forgot to send her cards but wanted to. But in reality, Jessica probably gets that many cards from other people, wouldn't have to fake it. I feel like she gets so many cards. That just made me think of that when she said she would write, and I was like, Jessica knows a lot of people. She must get so much mail. So she says goodbye to Nan. Everyone else, those people, the daughters and their husbands or whatever, they all leave. Another thing I forgot to mention is the whole reason they arrested Nan, fake arrested Nan in the first place, was so they could show her what her father was trying to show her, that the guy that's into her is just out for money. And I think that's really sweet that they did that whole thing, which makes me, like, think that, first of all, that whole scheme to begin with was way, way too big. They could have easily framed that man, and showed Nan that, he was no good without having to fake kill their father. Like, that was so extra. I mean, Jessica did it so easily by just arresting Nan, having the boy come in, and then the sheriff, like, kind of says, well, if you two were together, like, you could be in on it, and then he, like, backs out. It's sweet that they, like, they did that for the father. So at the end, Jessica gets the Captain Ethan Craig. He drives up in his gross, rusted old, shitty pickup truck. And he's like, so, it's almost like they're flirting, kind of. He's like, so, fish are biting. And so they end up going fishing, and then she's like, I can tell you a few things about fishing. And he's like, uh-huh, because, like, that's totally his career. And then he's like, do I have to bait your hook every time still? And she's like, well, you always do. And that is such great dialogue. Like, obviously, I'm, like, paraphrasing it. But that's such a, like, a pure friendship that I have friendships like that. Things like that have totally been said. I have, those interactions are so realistic. And honestly, like, the writing is really good. When carving out characters, and even the scenes that aren't related to the murder or the mysteries, they're very well written. It's not all, hurry up, throw some filler in there so we can get to the good stuff. Like, all of it's good. It is all quality. Well, that's the end of Season 1, Episode 3 of Murder, She Wrote.